Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I wish to apologize for the topic because I think that maybe for lunch you would have dreamed of anything else. But we brought you some chocolate and we hope that this will be sweet enough. First of all, I wish to thank ISIS Malaysia and ASEAN ISIS to give me the opportunity to address this August Assembly. It's a real honor and privilege. My aim is to give some thoughts on evolving conflicts. It's a very broad topic. Several speakers during the last 2 days referred to conflict prevention and conflict resolution. On my side, I will speak more of conflict management and the reality of conflict. These thoughts are based on the observations of an organization whose mission is to respond to the needs of people adversely affected by situations of humanitarian concern, in particular armed conflicts and violence. An independent and non-political organization, the ICRC is present in some 80 countries throughout the world with a large scope of activities. Our objective is not to settle conflict or bring any country to an end state of a stable and fair society. We aim to protect human dignity, to save life, and to alleviate human suffering. We also have a special relationship with and responsibilities as regards international humanitarian law. While referring to the region, I wish also to broaden the scope and focus on current challenges situated beyond the generally accepted border of Asia and Pacific and having global implications. Nurtured by our neutral, impartial, and independent approach and by a tradition of discussion and confidentiality, I will undoubtedly have more reserve on some issues than a political science expert would have. But please feel free to come with any questions you would like afterwards. In our analysis of the primary characteristic of current armed conflicts and other situations of violence, the following features emerge particularly strongly. First feature, the diversity of conflicts and situation of violence. There is no question that today's world is much more complex and that today's conflict environment has become increasingly heterogeneous and less predictable. This range from contexts where the most advanced technology and weapons systems are deployed in asymmetric confrontations to an assortment of conflicts characterized by low technology in which a variety of groups generate extensive insecurity without forgetting terrorist-like actions. The predominant form of conflict today, the non-international armed conflict, often involves a plethora of actors. It usually involves some degree of regional or international interference and often stems from state weakness that leaves room for local militias and armed groups to take matters into their own hands. This includes a large range of non-state actors, transnational clandestine networks, private militias, and security companies. The chain of command is not always well organized and the structure might be highly volatile. Today's conflicts are increasingly economic in nature and revolve primarily around competition for access to critical energy resources. They might also have tribal, ethnic, or religious dimensions and might be characterized by the coexistence of political and non-political players. The easy availability of arms, particularly small arms, is also an important factor to consider. Multiple factors, local, national, regional, and global, often coexist and have overlapping impact on populations at risk. Here, I have notably in mind, besides open hostilities, issues such as environmental degradation, drought, floods, and pandemics. This also refers to context affected by the interplay of local issues and wider-reaching concerns relating to the fight against terrorism. This can lead to an environment where looting and trafficking, including human trafficking and drug smuggling, extortion, piracy and kidnapping, turn into profitable economic strategies sustained by violence. The violence is primarily against civilians, with direct confrontations between armed groups or with armed state armed forces tending to be rare. Armed groups live off the population and engage in appalling acts of brutality to instill fear, ensure control, and obtain new recruits. There is also a blurring of identity between combatants and civilians. Some of these characteristics are also very present in situations which fall short of armed conflicts and where force and collective violence are used. In some places, urban violence might sometimes have similar consequences as conflicts. This trend is apparently becoming more widespread, notably in South America. Such a variety of situations makes it particularly difficult to define an appropriate response in humanitarian terms. Keywords are flexibility and a wide scope of activities. The second important feature to mention is high fragmentation. The various nature of conflicts and the increasingly economical prominent features lead to more and more fragmentation within armed forces. For example, in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the ICRC has to deal with 40 different armed groups or factions, and in Darfur, Sudan, more than 20. Cases in points in the Asia-Pacific region are notably Afghanistan, Myanmar, and the Philippines. For humanitarian organizations, this means having to adapt working modalities and might have direct consequences on the management of their own security. The third feature is duration of armed conflict. Israelis and Palestinians, Afghans, Filipinos, Colombians, Somalis and Sudanese, to name a few, have all been enduring conflict for 2, 3, or 4 decades. Protracted situations of conflict exist in many contexts, which fluctuate between phases of high and low intensity and instability, often without solutions for lasting peace, and with huge impact on people in terms of immediate survival needs, but also in terms of longer-term chronic needs. For humanitarian organizations, this means the requirement to have the stamina to work on certain issues in the medium and long term, and the flexibility to respond decisively to rapid onset of emergency situations. The fourth feature is easier access to information, connectivity of people, and globalization of issues. In general, the community of states and the people in general know much better what is going on, and in particular, if and when atrocities are committed. With the new means of communication, mobile phones and social media, spreading of news and pictures is incredibly quick. It is widely documented, for example, that new means of communication played a central role in Middle East and North America in the so-called Arab Spring. Problems affecting one country cross border and become regional or even international concerns. Hence, the need often mentioned in this conference to strengthen regional cooperation, as it is the case with ASEAN and other related constructs in Asia-Pacific. It also happens now that humanitarian organizations are directly contacted by victims and affected persons, including with regard to the aid provided or which should be provided. This also means that humanitarian organizations are more exposed to media scrutiny and questioning and are required to justify more often what they do or do not do. The fifth feature is heightened security challenges facing humanitarian organizations. Humanitarian action appears to be rejected with growing frequency by a wide range of armed groups, including for the reason of being perceived as insufficiently independent of political and military agenda and being instrumentalized. Attacks on humanitarian workers have been numerous in many contexts. There were also many instances of banditry, with a particular increase in kidnapping for ransom. All this means reduced access for humanitarian organizations in places where the population might be in dire need of strict humanitarian assistance. Looking at countries in which the ICRC currently runs some of its largest operations, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, and recently also Ivory Coast, it is striking how few aid agencies are actually able to gain regular access to populations and run independent operations. Deliberate attacks against humanitarian personnel are clearly illegal and unacceptable and must be condemned in the strongest terms. They take place against a backdrop of blatant lack of respect for international humanitarian law by states and non-state actors, which lies at the heart of large-scale suffering we are witnessing. We, however, also see the rejection of humanitarians as the byproduct of policies that integrate humanitarian aid into political and military strategies. Indeed, in various contexts, we witness an increased instrumentalization, politicization, and militarization of humanitarian aid. Libya is also a case in point where humanitarian issues and aid were invoked to justify intervention. I will come back on this later. The humanitarian world has evolved rapidly over the past few years as more and more players enter the arena, often with different objectives, operating standards, and activities. The ICRC has been very consistent in raising concern in the blurring of lines debate about the appropriateness for armed forces to be involved in humanitarian activities. On this, we make a clear distinction between situations of natural disasters and of armed conflict and other situations of violence. For us, the question is not whether the military can contribute to humanitarian efforts. It, for example, has an obligation under international humanitarian law to evacuate wounded civilians. We are also very aware that there is not only one way to help and that people often are grateful for help from a range of sources. The ICRC does not either claim that there is only one definition of humanitarian efforts. No one has a monopoly on humanitarian action. There are also situations where humanitarian organizations are not in a position to carry out the activities, for example, for security reasons, and where the willingness of states to commit troops is obviously the only possibility to do humanitarian work and save lives. However, aid becoming part of counterinsurgency strategies, as in Afghanistan, is much more problematic. This includes the exploitation of aid by states as a tool for conflict management and as an instrument to promote their own interests. In the case of Libya, the political, military, and humanitarian agendas of the key international players might be difficult to separate clearly, at least in the public opinion and perception. Such developments lead parties to conflicts and affected populations to associate all humanitarians with specific political and military goals. When humanitarian action becomes part of strategies aimed at defeating an enemy, the risk for aid agency in the field grows exponentially. This is when a bright red line must be drawn. Some might question the value of independent, neutral, and impartial humanitarianism in today's war. However, as an organization present and active in conflict for close to 160 years, including in those fought by insurgents, we know that these very principles enable us to reach, assist, and seek to protect those caught in armed conflict. A little known facet of our activities in Afghanistan illustrates the value of independent humanitarian action. Since 2007, the ICRC has been able to organize safe passage for Afghan Ministry of Health and World Health Organization workers who carry out polio vaccination for children in the south of the country. This safe space is negotiated with the Taliban and respected by US, NATO, and Afghan security forces. The ICRC regularly facilitates the transfer of wounded and handover operations for released hostages. Operations of this kind are only possible because all parties to the Afghan conflict know that we do not take sides and intervene on strictly humanitarian grounds. In Libya, the fact that we operate both from Tripoli and from Benghazi is also an expression of neutrality and independence. The aid community is very diverse in its approaches. In fact, our experience tells us that there is simply no such things as a pre-established protected humanitarian space. In today's armed conflicts, particularly when protracted and fragmented, the space needed for actions is created daily and over time. By building relations, by trying to talk to a very large diversity of persons, including some very difficult groups and people who do not necessarily immediately recognize the principles that we work with, by not taking acceptance for granted, by matching words with deeds, by adopting a principled approach and following it with great discipline. The ICRC, for one, believes in constant neutrality and independence as a way to build trust. It wants its own action to be clearly understood as separate and recognized for its distinct added value. The sixth feature I would like to stress is the importance, but also the difficulty, to acknowledge the applicability of the appropriate legal framework and work for its implementation. Irrespective of the change in the form and nature, conflicts and situations of violence always mean suffering for individuals caught in it. People are killed or injured. They witness the suffering of their families. They are separated from their loved ones, displaced and dispossessed. The world witnesses today too many conflicts where civilians are deliberately targeted. With regard to armed conflicts, the use of force is governed by two distinct bodies of law. On one side, there is a law directly governing the resort to force, also called use ad bellum. In internal or intrastate situations, the relevant law is national law, which must be in conformity with international law and which basically prohibits the use of force except for law enforcement and other authorities. In international or interstate conflicts, the UN Charter is nowadays the basis for the use of force. Basically, such use is possible only in the case of a threat to international peace and security. In the case of Libya, the use of force was authorized by UN Security Council Resolution 1973 under some conditions. The resolution authorizes to take all necessary measures to establish a no-fly zone and protect civilians under attack, while excluding a foreign occupation force of any form. On the other side, there is the law applicable to situations of armed conflict, also called use in bello, which regulates the use of means and methods of warfare and protects civilians, objects, and the persons who do not participate in hostilities. This is international humanitarian law, also known as the law of armed conflict, mainly contained in the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols. International humanitarian law applies equally to all sides of an armed conflict, regardless of the reason for resort to force or its legality. Accordingly, once an armed conflict exists, all parties involved must comply with the relevant provisions of international humanitarian law, in particular at a minimum by adhering to the principle of distinction, proportionality, and military necessity. Over years, we noted the reluctance by states to acknowledge that a situation amounts to armed conflict, mainly in case of intrastate conflict. Setting and applying the appropriate legal framework is key to turn legal provisions into reality, take seriously one's obligation to protect civilians, reduce the number of victims, and address their needs. History also teaches that respect for international humanitarian law during conflict helps paving way to reconciliation, and the limitation of atrocities prepares for conflict resolution. With regard to Libya, shortly after the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 1973, the ICRC handed over a reminder of humanitarian applicable law in military operations between the members of the coalition in the making and the Libyan government. Even if the stated aim of these operations was the protection of civilians, international humanitarian law applies with regard to the way military operations are conducted, the treatment of possible prisoners, the limitation of collateral damages, etc. Another case is in point in the region are the military clashes between Thailand and Cambodia in February and April, which undoubtedly were an armed conflict in the sense of the Geneva Conventions between the armed forces of two sovereign countries, irrespective of the reason of the fighting. The seventh feature I wish to emphasize is the protection of civilians, human security, and the responsibility to protect. The ICRC was in the past one of the few organizations implementing protection activities. Now there are many. This notion stays at the heart of our mandate. We define protection as efforts which aim at ensuring that the authorities and armed carriers respect the obligations and the rights of the individuals in accordance with international humanitarian law and other relevant bodies of law in order to preserve the life, safety, integrity, and dignity of those affected. The ICRC has some special features in its protection work, which make it unique because of its principles and working methods and the large scope and nature of possible activities implemented. The challenge of protecting civilians in all its various dimensions is a daunting one. The work by a humanitarian organization cannot be conceived in isolation and is an element contributing to a favorable environment along with other intervening parties. The various parties which bear different responsibilities and carry out a variety of activities include the authorities, who have a primary responsibility and whose shortcomings or abuses trigger the need for separate but complementary action by others, the persons and communities affected or potentially affected, who can take certain independent measures to avoid risk and protect themselves, states other than that of the authorities concerned, which have a responsibility to ensure respect of international humanitarian law and various other duties embodied in the UN Charter. Finally, regulatory or helping mechanism, in particular groups and components of civil society, international tribunals, media, NGOs, UN agencies, the ICRC, etc. In general, one might consider that a comprehensive response to protect people involves different roles and responsibilities for the political power, for the military force and police, for the judicial power and rule of law, and for humanitarian actors. It is important that action be taken in distinct protection domains as required, and that there is no confusion and blurring of lines between each other. With the proliferation of actors claiming to carry out protection work, effective and meaningful coordination must be based more on genuine respect of certain basic principles than on ever more defined mechanism and procedures of coordination. With the emergence of the human security concept, the ICRC felt pretty comfortable as the concept was overarching and as the ICRC did not see any contradiction between this concept, irrespective of the debate about definitions and scope, and its own practice, priority and concerns. Our constant practice has been to put emphasis on the individuals, to consider a given situation globally, to assess needs, risks and threats as globally as possible, and to feel concerned by all the needs of all persons affected by armed conflict and other situations of violence, of course, within the scope of our mandate. The protection of civilians has been on the agenda of the UN Security Council for a thematic yearly debate for the last 10 years. Other significant development has been the emergence of the concept of responsibility to protect, or R2P, which requests states to take actions in case of occurrence of four major crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing, based on the UN Charter. When this political concept was endorsed by the 2005 World Summit, it was divided into three pillars, the third one being the most sensitive or contentious, with the possibility to take collective coercive measures to ensure a failing authority complying with its obligations. In the Libyan case, the R2P construct has been discussed. Indeed, UN Security Resolution 1970 that imposes sanctions and refers the situation to the International Criminal Court recalls the Libyan authorities' responsibility to protect its population. UN Security Resolution 1973, which authorized the use of force, does not refer expressly to the R2P, but has been widely seen as a case of application. As mentioned before, this resolution belongs to use at Belum. The operations it authorizes might ultimately aim at improving the situation and protection of civilians, but do not directly improve the physical protection and has generated collateral damages. It has also other stated strategic objectives. Civilians' deaths and injury have undoubtedly been prevented, but concerns have been raised in terms of the potential undermining of the protection of civilian agenda in general. Despite or because of these initiatives to protect civilians, the challenge of providing impartial and neutral humanitarian aid to the people in the midst of this armed conflict has become even more difficult. The international humanitarian community has been severely put to the test in Libya, where the humanitarian situation is dire and continuing to get worse. Ladies and gentlemen, in conclusion, armed conflict and other situations of violence are by definition highly sensitive matters. States appear willing to participate in any future dialogue on new avenues to strengthen international humanitarian law. It is my fervent hope that the challenges I have outlined today will spur you to engage in the debate. We will find my colleagues in the ICRC delegations and office throughout Asia and the Pacific eager to support you in these endeavors. As the roundtable draws to a close tomorrow, I also hope that your assessment of the security challenges facing the region will focus not only on those of a political security nature, but will also take into account the humanitarian dimension. The security policies of states are meaningless if they are not directed first and foremost to protect their people. I thank you for your attention.